Emma and Nelson, Part 4. Paradise Merton. Appointing Nelson Commander-in-Chief of a squadron defending the English Channel from an expected French invasion calmed and reassured the public and the City of London. With Nelson in charge, it was felt that Napoleon's army of the invasion of England would probably never leave port. The new post also suited Nelson, as he was able to make visits to London and have Emma and Sir William visit him on board his ship. By this time, Sir William was providing for Emma Carew, Emma's first child by Sir Harry Featherstone Hall. Nelson at this point did not know of the existence of this person, but when he eventually did, he made her welcome. Perhaps feeling the need to do something decisive, on the 4th of August, 1801, Nelson launched an attack against the invasion forces gathered at Boulogne. It was an operation that involved 900 officers and men. Unusually for Nelson, he devised the attack plan but did not personally take part. The intention was to destroy a flotilla of boats, but it was a disaster. It left 44 sailors dead and 128 wounded. Nelson's young protege, Edward Parker, had his thigh shattered. Later, the leg was amputated. Nelson visited Parker many times in hospital and referred to him in letters as his son. When Parker died, he was overwhelmed with grief. "I shall never bring myself again to allow any attack to go forward where I am not personally concerned," he wrote. This attitude would likely contribute to the amount of danger that he exposed himself to at Trafalgar. Emma had by now found a house with land at Merton in Surrey. It was in need of modernisation and had no stabling or coach house. The surveyor was damning about the whole place, describing the small canal that ran through it as a broad ditch which keeps the whole place damp. Nelson, however, bought it, sight unseen, for £9,000. Borrowing off the ever-reliable Alexander Davidson. Emma renamed the ditch the Nile, filled it with fish, and built an Italianate bridge over it. She brought in trees and shrubs, and Nelson was soon referring to the place as the farm. Emma also spent extravagantly on the house's exterior and interior. She filled it with Nelson and Emma memorabilia, including paintings of herself and Nelson, mirrors and rich decorations. It was a home for a seafaring hero, a bucolic sanctuary bedecked with reminders of Nelson's triumphs. The impression given in period films is that this was an age of pared-back elegance, but in fact homes were often very cluttered, and this was certainly the case with Merton. On Friday, the 23rd of October 1801, Nelson arrived to see his home for the first time, driving through a triumphal arch erected by the Merton villagers. At 10 o'clock on the Monday, he went to 23 Piccadilly to meet his 10-month-old daughter, Horatia. For appearance's sake, he could not bring Horatia to live with him. But Emma managed to get Nelson's 80-year-old father to come and stay, and she took such good care of the old man, he fell for her completely. In fact, Nelson's other family came to stay often at the house, particularly the Matchams and the Boltons, the families of his sisters, Kitty and Susanna, who incidentally is my great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. Emma did now let Nelson know about her first daughter, Emma Carew, the illegitimate daughter of Sir Harry Featherstone Hall, and she too was made welcome at Merton. On the 25th of March 1802, the Treaty of Amiens was signed and it seemed that the war with France was over. In July of that year, Nelson, Emma and Sir William set off on a triumphal tour, heading first to Oxford. They were met everywhere with immense cheering crowds, receptions and banquets. Emma was once again inspiring fashion, and even novels were written about the love triangle of Emma, Nelson and William, though they rendered it all very virtuous and chaste. In 1802, Sir William wrote, "I was sensible and said so when I married, that I should be superannuated when my wife would be in her full beauty and vigour of youth. That time has arrived, and we must make the best of it." But back at Merton, William complained that there was seldom less than 12 or 14 at table, and those varying continually. He was growing old and was getting tired of the endless entertaining. Like a modern celebrity, on trips to Margate, Emma was hounded by the press, gawpers, and even obsessive fans eager to touch her. She had to work hard to keep Horatia out of the newspapers. It all got too much for Sir William, and a scrap of paper survives hinting at their rows. In one he concludes, "I have but a very short time to live, and every moment is precious to me." At Merton there were many visitors, including two of the king's sons, William, Duke of Clarence, and Augustus, Duke of Sussex. Household expenses were colossal, and Emma, as always, was overspending. Great actors, opera stars, as well as Nelson's family, all were entertained to the very highest standards. In modern money, Emma was spending £3,600 a week on food alone. By late March of 1803, Sir William was dying. Along with her mother and Nelson, Emma nursed him. On the 6th of April, he died in Emma's arms, with Nelson holding his hand at the house in Piccadilly. "Unhappy day for the forlorn Emma," wrote Emma. "At 10 minutes past 10, dear, blessed Sir William left me. He had been her partner since she was 21 and her husband for 12 years. Her creditors closed in quickly and she was forced to take another house in London at Clarges Street, needing somewhere other than Merton for appearance's sake. Emma received an annuity in Sir William's will of £800, £100 of which was for her mother, Mrs. Cadogan. But Sir William's very considerable estate went to her old lover, Charles Greville, Sir William's nephew, who had rid himself of Emma by sending her to Naples all those years ago. Sir William's estate was large, but it was beset with debts, and Greville was not to be particularly punctilious about paying Emma her due. She almost certainly deserved a pension due to her role both in ensuring the resupplying of the fleet before the Battle of the Nile and in passing secrets between the King of Spain and the British government, but she received nothing. In his will, Sir William left Nelson an enamel version of the same sensual portrait of Emma that he had saved from the Christie's sale. Sir William would have known that Nelson would have hated the thought of this object falling into Greville's hands, so it seems to have been an act of real friendship. For now, Emma received £1,200 a year from Nelson, and they both lived in the hope that he would become hugely wealthy through the prize money system, as so many of his fellow officers had done. But this was never to be. By the autumn of 1803, the Peace of Amiens was falling apart. Nelson was offered the position of Commander-in-Chief of the Mediterranean Fleet. As he set off, Emma realised she was again pregnant. The child, a girl called Emma, did not survive long, and Emma was forced to conceal her grief from the public. With Nelson away, she was isolated and began to drink and take laudanum to assuage the pain and discomfort of a range of health problems. Of Nelson she wrote, "I am anxious and agitated to see him. I love him, I adore him. My mind and soul is now transported with the thought of that blessed, ecstatic moment when I shall see him, embrace him. My love is no common love." In the coming months and years, Napoleon constantly changed his mind when it came to how best to use his maritime forces, but his focus never entirely shifted from his aim of invading England. Bonaparte believed that he needed to control the English Channel for just 8 hours in order to finally achieve this. It was a plan that had been years in the making, and invasion craft were still ready on the north coast of France, and much of the preparation completed. A coin had even been minted, prematurely celebrating a successful invasion of England. Many of Napoleon's ships were trapped in French ports, which were scrupulously and tirelessly blockaded by the British. But when storms blew up, they often blew the blockading ships off their stations, allowing the enemy to put to sea. Napoleon ordered his ships to escape port and make for the West Indies. There they could inflict damage on Britain's colonial possessions, draw the British away from the Channel, then sneak back and precipitate the invasion of England. It was a plan that now led to Nelson being continually at sea for over 2 years, without once stepping foot on land, as he desperately scoured the oceans for the French, worrying himself half to death about being responsible for allowing the invasion of his country if he made a wrong move. For her part, Emma began to slip into a lifestyle of occasional binge drinking, excessive eating, and the increasing use of laudanum, a highly addictive tincture of opium, to treat a range of painful illnesses. In the winter of 1804, Nelson was expected to return to Merton, and Emma spent extravagantly in order to try and speed up and complete extensive renovations. She also spent extravagantly on furniture, but Nelson did not come. In January 1805, he was expected again, and again Emma's debts rose as she spent lavishly to prepare the house for the hero. Again he did not arrive. In May 1805, Horatia left the home of her nurse, Mrs. Gibson, and finally came to live permanently at what Nelson was now referring to as Paradise Merton. Nelson wrote a letter, which could be shown to anyone demanding to know who Horatia was. It stated that she was an orphan entrusted to his care in Naples. Mrs. Gibson had to be paid off with a pension of £20 a year to keep her quiet. On the 19th of August 1805, Emma cut short a holiday at Southend, leaving at 5 a.m. in a postchaise carriage, having received news that Nelson had returned. She had not seen her lover for 2 years and 3 months. The reunion took place in the early morning. Nelson was delighted with Merton, which was now a fine country house with landscaped grounds and an interior bedecked with images and trinkets celebrating his achievements. At heart, Nelson was a simple sailor, and like any Jack Tar, he wanted to see mementos of his life at sea. It just so happened that with him, this meant lavish dinner services and paintings celebrating great victories. It might be expected that the one-armed Nelson with his sightless eye might now be a worn-out husk, but witnesses found him in good spirits. He was much in demand, and when he appeared in any street in London, huge crowds gathered and followed him, cheering. Emma entertained at Merton, throwing large, boisterous dinners, at which Nelson was the centre of attention. With Sir William gone, Nelson and Emma could enjoy each other and live as man and wife. Most importantly, Horatia was with them, but this much longed-for idyll was cut cruelly short. Within a fortnight, Captain Blackwood arrived at Merton to inform Nelson that the French fleet under Admiral Villeneuve had been spotted at Cadiz. Within 3 days, Nelson was gone. Emma wrote, "It seems as though I have had a fortnight's dream, and am awoke to the misery of this cruel separation." In his diary, Nelson wrote, "Friday night at 10:30, drove from dear, dear Merton, where I left all I hold dear to this world, to go to serve my king and country." Once on board Victory, he wrote to Emma, "Cheer up, and we will look forward to many happy years and be surrounded by our children's children." "The dearest husband of my heart," wrote Emma, "you are all in this world to your Emma. May God send you victory and home to your Emma, Horatia, and Paradise Merton. For when you are there, it will be paradise." At Cadiz, Nelson joined the British fleet of 27 ships of the line. The effect of his arrival was electric, with crews lining the decks to cheer him. When the combined Franco-Spanish fleet of 33 ships of the line came out of port, a major battle became inevitable. Nelson insisted not only on leading the attack in the victory, but on wearing his full uniform with his highly visible collection of stars and other decorations on his coat, making him an obvious target for sharpshooters. This was how he always fought his battles, and he wasn't going to change now. It was probably a combination of superstition and personal style. He was a man who had already become a myth. For him to wear a plain coat and lurk at the back of the fleet was unthinkable. The crews in the fleet were already now fired up, with their unique dedication and zeal. They were going to fight a major fleet engagement with Nelson in command, the dream of every Jack Tar of that time. Nelson himself prepared for battle by writing a codicil to his will and a prayer for victory. The codicil stated, "I leave Emma, Lady Hamilton, therefore a legacy to my king and country, that they will give her an ample provision to maintain her rank in life. I also leave to the beneficence of my country my adopted daughter, Horatia Nelson Thompson, and I desire she will use in future the name of Nelson only. These are the only favours I ask of my king and country at this moment when I am going to fight their battle." To Horatia he wrote, "Dearest angel, you are so very good a girl, and love my dear Lady Hamilton, who most dearly loves you." Days before this, he had written Emma a poem which ended, "Should conquest smile on Britain's fleet, as at the Nile, with joyful hearts upon the beach we'll meet. No more I'll tempt the dangers of the sea, but live in Merton's groves with love and thee." His prayer before battle read, "May the great God whom I worship grant to my country and the benefit of Europe in general a great and glorious victory. And may no misconduct in anyone tarnish it. And may humanity after victory be the predominant feature in the British fleet. For myself individually, I commit my life to him who made me, and may his blessing light upon my endeavours for serving my country faithfully. To him I resign myself and the just cause which is entrusted to me to defend." To find out what happened next, listen to the last episode in this podcast mini-series, entitled Immortal Hero. It includes a description of the battle and what happened afterwards. And please do go to trafalgar.tv to support the TV miniseries, which is currently in development with Particular Productions. We need to prove to streaming service executives that there is a wide interest in this subject and that the world is ready for a full, glorious, sumptuous, colourful telling of this incredible story. Thanks for listening.